Side 10, The Autobiography of Malcolm X, continuing on page 337. New York seemed a million miles away. I hadn't seen a newspaper that I could read since I left New York. I had no idea what was happening there. A Negro rifle club that had been in existence for over 12 years in Harlem had been discovered by the police. It was being trumpeted that I was behind it. Elijah Muhammad's Nation of Islam had a lawsuit going against me to force me and my family to vacate the house in which we lived on Long Island. The major press, radio, and television media in America had representatives in Cairo hunting all over, trying to locate me, to interview me about the furor in New York that I had allegedly caused when I knew nothing about any of it. I only knew what I'd left in America and how it contrasted with what I'd found in the Muslim world. About 20 of us Muslims who had finished the Hajj was sitting in a huge tent on Mount Arafat. As a Muslim from America, I was the center of attention. They asked me what about the Hajj had impressed me the most. One of the several who spoke English asked. They translated my answers for the others. My answer to that question was not the one they expected, but it drove home my point. I said, "The Brotherhood. The people of all races, colors, from all over the world coming together as one. It has proved to me the power of the one God." It may have been out of taste, but that gave me an opportunity, and I used it, to preach them a quick little sermon on America's racism and its evils. I could tell the impact of this upon them. They had been aware that the plight of the black man in America was bad, but they had not been aware that it was inhuman, that it was a psychological castration. These people from elsewhere around the world were shocked. As Muslims, they had a very tender heart for all unfortunates, and very sensitive feelings for truth and justice. And in everything I said to them, as long as we talked, they were aware of the yardstick that I was using to measure everything. That to me, the earth's most explosive and pernicious evil is racism, the inability of God's creatures to live as one, especially in the Western world. I have reflected since that the letter I finally sat down to compose had been subconsciously shaping itself in my mind. The color blindness of the Muslim world's religious society and the color blindness of the Muslim world's human society. These two influences had each day been making a greater impact and an increasing persuasion against my previous way of thinking. The first letter was, of course, to my wife, Betty. I never had a moment's question that Betty, after initial amazement, would change her thinking to join mine. I had known 1,000 reassurances that Betty's faith in me was total. I knew that she would see what I had seen, that in the land of Muhammad and the land of Abraham, I had been blessed by Allah with a new insight into the true religion of Islam and a better understanding of America's entire racial dilemma. After the letter to my wife, I wrote next essentially the same letter to my sister Ella, and I knew where Ella would stand. She had been saving to make the pilgrimage to Mecca herself. I wrote to Dr. Shawabi, whose belief in my sincerity had enabled me to get a passport to Mecca. All through the night, I copied similar long letters for others who were very close to me. Among them was Elijah Muhammad's son, Wallace Muhammad, who had expressed to me his conviction that the only possible salvation for the Nation of Islam would be its accepting and projecting a better understanding of Orthodox Islam. And I wrote to my loyal assistants at my newly formed Muslim Mosque Incorporated in Harlem, with a note appended, asking that my letter be duplicated and distributed to the press. I knew that when my letter became public knowledge back in America, many would be astounded, loved ones, friends, and enemies alike. And no less astounded would be millions whom I did not know, who had gained during my 12 years with Elijah Muhammad a hate image of Malcolm X. Even I was myself astounded, but there was precedent in my life for this letter. My whole life had been a chronology of changes. Here is what I wrote from my heart. Never have I witnessed such sincere hospitality and the overwhelming spirit of true brotherhood as is practiced by people of all colors and races here in this ancient holy land, the home of Abraham, Muhammad, and all the other prophets of the Holy Scriptures. For the past week, I have been utterly speechless and spellbound by the graciousness I see displayed all around me by people of all colors. I have been blessed to visit the holy city of Mecca. I have made my 7 circuits around the Kaaba, led by a young mutawaf named Muhammad. I drank water from the well of Zemzem. I ran 7 times back and forth between the hills of Mount Al-Safa and Al-Mawa. I have prayed in the ancient city of Mina, and I have prayed on Mount Arafat. There were tens of thousands of pilgrims from all over the world. They were of all colors, from blue-eyed blondes to black-skinned Africans. But we were all participating in the same ritual, displaying a spirit of unity and brotherhood that my experiences in America had led me to believe never could exist between the white and the non-white. America needs to understand Islam, because this is the one religion that erases from its society the race problem. Throughout my travels in the Muslim world, I have met, talked to, and even eaten with people who in America would have been considered white. But the white attitude was removed from their minds by the religion of Islam. I have never before seen sincere and true brotherhood practiced by all colors together, irrespective of their color. You may be shocked by these words coming from me, but on this pilgrimage, what I have seen and experienced has forced me to rearrange much of my thought patterns previously held and to toss aside some of my previous conclusions. This was not too difficult for me. Despite my firm convictions, I have been always a man who tries to face facts and to accept the reality of life as new experience and new knowledge unfolds it. I have always kept an open mind, which is necessary to the flexibility that must go hand in hand with every form of intelligent search for truth. During the past 11 days here in the Muslim world, I have eaten from the same plate, drunk from the same glass, and slept in the same bed or on the same rug, while praying to the same God, with fellow Muslims whose eyes were the bluest of blue, whose hair was the blondest of blonde, and whose skin was the whitest of white. And in the words, and in the actions, and in the deeds of the white Muslims, I felt the same sincerity that I felt among the black African Muslims of Nigeria, Sudan, and Ghana. We were truly all the same, brothers, because their belief in one God had removed the white from their minds, the white from their behavior, and the white from their attitude. I could see from this that perhaps if white Americans could accept the oneness of God, then perhaps, too, they could accept in reality the oneness of man and cease to measure and hinder and harm others in terms of their differences in color. With racism plaguing America like an incurable cancer, the so-called Christian white American heart should be more receptive to a proven solution to such a destructive problem. Perhaps it could be in time to save America from imminent disaster, the same destruction brought upon Germany by racism that eventually destroyed the Germans themselves. Each hour here in the Holy Land enables me to have greater spiritual insights into what is happening in America between black and white. The American Negro never can be blamed for his racial animosities. He is only reacting to 400 years of the conscious racism of the American whites. But as racism leads America up the suicide path, I do believe, from the experiences that I've had with them, that the whites of the younger generation, in the colleges and universities, will see the handwriting on the wall, and many of them will turn to the spiritual path of truth, the only way left to America to ward off the disaster that racism inevitably must lead to. Never have I been so highly honored. Never have I been made to feel more humble and unworthy. Who would believe the blessings that have been heaped upon an American Negro? A few nights ago, a man who would be called in America a white man, a United Nations diplomat, an ambassador, a companion of kings, gave me his hotel suite, his bed. By this man, His Excellency Prince Faisal, who rules this holy land, was made aware of my presence here in Jeddah. The very next morning, Prince Faisal's son, in person, informed me that by the will and decree of his esteemed father, I was to be a state guest. The deputy chief of protocol himself took me before the Hajj court. His Holiness Sheikh Mohammed Hakon himself okayed my visit to Mecca. His Holiness gave me two books on Islam, with his personal seal and autograph, and he told me that he prayed that I would be a successful preacher of Islam in America. A car, a driver, and a guide have been placed at my disposal, making it possible for me to travel about this holy land almost at will. The government provides air-conditioned quarters and servants in each city that I visit. Never would I have even thought of dreaming that I would ever be a recipient of such honors. Honors that in America would be bestowed upon a king, not a Negro. All praise is due to Allah, the Lord of all the worlds. Sincerely, El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz, Malcolm X. Chapter 18, El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz. Prince Faisal, the absolute ruler of Arabia, had made me a guest of the state. Among the courtesies and privileges which this brought to me, especially, shamelessly, I relished the chauffeured car which toured me around in Mecca with the chauffeur guide pointing out sites of particular significance. Some of the holy city looked as ancient as time itself. Other parts of it resembled a modern Miami suburb. I cannot describe with what feelings I actually pressed my hands against the earth where the great prophets had trod 4,000 years before. The Muslim from America excited everywhere the most intense curiosity and interest. I was mistaken time and again for Cassius Clay. A local newspaper printed a photograph of Cassius and me together at the United Nations. Through my chauffeur, guide, interpreter, I was asked scores of questions about Cassius. Even children knew of him and loved him there in the Muslim world. By popular demand, the cinemas throughout Africa and Asia had shown his fight. At that moment in young Cassius' career, he had captured the imagination and the support of the entire dark world. My car took me to participate in special prayers at Mount Arafat and at Mina. The roads offered the wildest drives that I'd ever known. Nightmare traffic, brakes squealing, skidding cars, and horns blowing. I believe that all of the driving in the Holy Land is done in the name of Allah. I'd begun to learn the prayers in Arabic. Now my biggest prayer difficulty was physical. The unaccustomed prayer posture had caused my big toe to swell, and it pained me. But the Muslim world's customs no longer seemed strange to me. My hands now readily plucked up food from a common dish shared with brother Muslims. I was drinking without hesitation from the same glass as others. I was washing from the same little pitcher of water, and sleeping with 8 or 10 others on a mat in the open. I remember one night at Muzdalifa, with nothing but the sky overhead, I lay awake amid sleeping Muslim brothers, and I learned that pilgrims from every land, every color and class and rank, high officials and the beggar alike, all snored in the same language. I'll bet that in the parts of the Holy Land that I visited, 1 million bottles of soft drinks were consumed, and 10 million cigarettes must have been smoked. Particularly the Arab Muslims smoked constantly, even on the Hajj pilgrimage itself. The smoking evil wasn't invented in Prophet Muhammad's days. If it had been, I believe he would have banned it. It was the largest Hajj in history, I was later told. Kasem Gulek of the Turkish Parliament, beaming with pride, informed me that from Turkey alone, over 600 buses, over 50,000 Muslims had made the pilgrimage. I told him that I dreamed to see the day when shiploads and plane loads of American Muslims would come to Mecca for the Hajj. There was a color pattern in the huge crowds. Once I happened to notice this, I closely observed it thereafter. Being from America made me intensely sensitive to matters of color. I saw that people who looked alike drew together, and most of the time stayed together. This was entirely voluntary, there being no other reason for it. But Africans were with Africans, Pakistanis were with Pakistanis, and so on. I tucked it into my mind that when I returned home I would tell Americans this observation, that where true brotherhood existed among all colors, where no one felt segregated, where there was no superiority complex, no inferiority complex, then voluntarily, naturally, people of the same kind felt drawn together by that which they had in common. It is my intention that by the time of my next Hajj pilgrimage, I will have at least a working vocabulary of Arabic. In my ignorant, crippled condition in the Holy Land, I have been lucky to have met patient friends who enabled me to talk by interpreting for me. Never before in my life had I felt so deaf and dumb as during the times when no interpreter was with me to tell me what was being said around me, or about me, or even to me by other Muslims, before they learned that the Muslim from America knew only a few prayers in Arabic, and beyond that, he could only nod and smile. Behind my nods and smiles, though, I was doing some American-type thinking and reflection. I saw that Islam's conversions around the world could double and triple if the colorfulness and the true spiritualness of the Hajj pilgrimage were properly advertised and communicated to the outside world. I saw that the Arabs are poor at understanding the psychology of non-Arabs and the importance of public relations. The Arabs said, Insha'Allah, God willing. Then they waited for converts. Even by this means, Islam was on the march. But I knew that with improved public relations methods, the number of new converts turning to Allah could be turned into millions. Constantly, wherever I went, I was asked questions about America's racial discrimination. Even with my background, I was astonished at the degree to which the major single image of America seemed to be discrimination. In 100 different conversations in the Holy Land with Muslims high and low, and from around the world, and later, when I got to Black Africa, I don't have to tell you, never once did I bite my tongue or miss a single opportunity to tell the truth about the crimes, the evils, and the indignities that are suffered by the black man in America. Through my interpreter, I lost no opportunity to advertise the American black man's real plight. I preached it on the mountain at Arafat. I preached it in the busy lobby of the Jeddah Palace Hotel. I would point it one after another to bring it closer to home. You, because of your dark skin in America, you too would be called Negro. You could be bombed and shot and cattle prodded and fire-hosed and beaten because of your complexions. As some of the poorest pilgrims heard me preach, so did some of the holy world's most important personages. I talked at length with the blue-eyed, blonde-haired Hussein Amini, Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. We were introduced on Mount Arafat by Kassem Gulek of the Turkish Parliament. Both were learned men. Both were especially well-read on America. Kassem Gulek asked me why I'd broken with Elijah Muhammad. I said that I preferred not to elaborate upon our differences in the interests of preserving the American black man's unity. They both understood and accepted that. I talked with the mayor of Mecca, Sheikh Abdullah Iraif, who when he was a journalist had criticized the methods of the Mecca municipality. And Prince Faisal made him the mayor to see if he could do any better. Everyone generally acknowledged that Sheikh Iraif was doing fine. A filmed feature, The Muslim from America, was made by Ahmed Horiala and his partner Esid Mohammed of Tunis Television Station. In America once, in Chicago, Ahmed Horiala had interviewed Elijah Muhammad. The lobby of the Jeddah Palace Hotel offered me frequent sizable informal audiences of important men from many different countries who were curious to hear the American Muslim. I met many Africans who had either spent some time in America or who had heard other Africans' testimony about America's treatment of the black man. I remember how before one large audience, one cabinet minister from black Africa, he knew more about worldwide current events than anyone else I've ever met, told of his occasionally traveling in the United States, north and south, deliberately not wearing his national dress. Just recalling the indignities he had met as a black man seemed to expose some raw nerve in this highly educated, dignified official. His eyes blazed in his passionate anger. His hands hacked the air. Why is the American black man so complacent about being trampled upon? Why doesn't the American black man fight to be a human being? A Sudanese high official hugged me. You champion the American black people. An Indian official wept in his compassion for my brothers in your land. I reflected many, many times to myself upon how the American Negro has been entirely brainwashed from ever seeing or thinking of himself as he should as a part of the non-white peoples of the world. The American Negro has no conception of the hundreds of millions of other non-whites concerned for him. He has no conception of their feeling of brotherhood for and with him. It was there in the Holy Land, and later in Africa, that I formed a conviction which I've had ever since, that a topmost requisite for any Negro leader in America ought to be extensive traveling in the non-white lands on this earth, and the travel should include many conferences with the ranking men of those lands. I guarantee that any honest, open-minded Negro leader would return home with more effective thinking about alternative avenues to solutions of the American black man's problem. Above all, the Negro leaders would find that many non-white officials of the highest standing, especially Africans, would tell them privately that they would be glad to throw their weight behind the Negro cause in the United Nations and in other ways. But these officials understandably feel that the Negro in America is so confused and divided that he doesn't himself know what his cause is. Again, it was mainly Africans who variously expressed to me that no one would wish to be embarrassed trying to help a brother who shows no evidence that he wants that help, and who seems to refuse to cooperate in his own interests. The American black leader's most critical problem is lack of imagination. His thinking, his strategies, if any, are always limited, at least basically, to only that which is either advised or approved by the white man. And the first thing the American power structure doesn't want any Negroes to start is thinking internationally. I think the single worst mistake of the American black organizations and their leaders is that they fail to establish direct brotherhood lines of communication between the independent nations of Africa and the American black people. Why, every day the black African heads of state should be receiving direct accounts of the latest developments in the American black man's struggles, instead of the U.S. State Department's releases to Africans, which always implied that the American black man's struggle is being solved. Two American authors, bestsellers in the Holy Land, had helped to spread and intensify the concern for the American black man. James Baldwin's books, translated, had made a tremendous impact, as had the book Black Like Me by John Griffin. If you're unfamiliar with that book, it tells how the white man Griffin blackened his skin and spent 2 months traveling as a Negro about America. Then Griffin wrote of the experiences that he met. "A frightening experience," I heard exclaimed many times by people in the Holy World who had read the popular book. But I never heard it without opening their thinking further. Well, if it was a frightening experience for him as nothing but a make-believe Negro for 60 days, then you think about what real Negroes in America have gone through for 400 years. One honor that came to me, I prayed for. His Eminence, Prince Faisal, invited me to a personal audience with him. As I entered the room, tall, handsome Prince Faisal came from behind his desk. I never will forget the reflection I had at that instant, that here was one of the world's most important men, and yet with his dignity one saw clearly his sincere humility. He indicated for me a chair opposite from his. Our interpreter was the Deputy Chief of Protocol, Mohammed Abdulaziz Maged, an Egyptian-born Arab who looked like a Harlem Negro. Prince Faisal impatiently gestured when I began stumbling for words, trying to express my gratitude for the great honor he had paid me in making me a guest of the state. It was only Muslim hospitality to another Muslim, he explained, and I was an unusual Muslim from America. He asked me to understand above all that whatever he had done had been his pleasure, with no other motives whatever. A gliding servant served a choice of two kinds of tea as Prince Faisal talked. His son, Muhammad Faisal, had met me on American television while attending a Northern California university. Prince Faisal had read Egyptian writers' articles about the American black Muslims. "If what these writers say is true, the black Muslims have the wrong Islam," he said. I explained my role of the previous 12 years, of helping to organize and to build the Nation of Islam. I said that my purpose for making the Hajj was to get an understanding of true Islam. "That is good," Prince Faisal said, pointing out that there was an abundance of English translation literature about Islam, so that there was no excuse for ignorance, and no reason for sincere people to allow themselves to be misled. The last of April, 1964, I flew to Beirut, the seaport capital of Lebanon. A part of me I left behind in the holy city of Mecca, and in turn I took away with me, forever, a part of Mecca. I was on my way now to Nigeria, then Ghana, but some friends I'd made in the Holy Land had urged and insisted that I make some stops en route, and I'd agreed. For example, it had been arranged that I would first stop and address the faculty and the students at the American University of Beirut. In Beirut's Palm Beach Hotel, I luxuriated in my first long sleep since I had left America. Then I went walking, fresh from weeks in the Holy Land. Immediately my attention was struck by the mannerisms and attire of the Lebanese women. In the Holy Land, there had been the very modest, very feminine Arabian women. And there was this sudden contrast of the half-French, half-Arab Lebanese women who projected in their dress and street manners more liberty, more boldness. I saw clearly the obvious European influence upon the Lebanese culture. It showed me how any country's moral strength or its moral weakness is quickly measurable by the street attire and attitude of its women, especially its young women. Wherever the spiritual values have been submerged, if not destroyed, by an emphasis upon the material things, invariably, the women reflect it. Witness the women, both young and old, in America, where scarcely any moral values are left. There seems in most countries to be either one extreme or the other. Truly, a paradise could exist wherever material progress and spiritual values could be properly balanced. I spoke of the University of Beirut, the truth of the American black man's condition. I previously made the comment that any experienced public speaker can feel his audience's reactions. As I spoke, I felt the subjective and defensive reactions of the American white students present. But gradually their hostilities lessened as I continued to present the unassailable facts. But the students of African heritage, well, I'll never get over how the African displays his emotions. Later, with astonishment, I heard that the American press carried stories that my Beirut speech caused a riot. What kind of a riot? I don't know how any reporter in good conscience could have cabled that across the ocean. The Beirut Daily Star front page report of my speech mentioned no riot, because there was none. When I was done, the African students all but besieged me for autographs. Some of them even hugged me. Never have even American Negro audiences accepted me as I've been accepted time and again by the less inhibited, more down-to-earth Africans. From Beirut, I flew back to Cairo, and there I took a train to Alexandria, Egypt. I kept my camera busy during each brief stopover. Finally, I was on a plane to Nigeria. During the six-hour flight, when I was not talking with the pilot, who had been a 1960 Olympic swimmer, I sat with a passionately political African. He almost shouted in his fervor, "When people are in a stagnant state and are being brought out of it, there is no time for voting." His central theme was that no new African nation trying to decolonize itself needed any political system that would permit division and bickering. The people don't know what the vote means. It is the job of the enlightened leaders to raise the people's intellect. In Lagos, I was greeted by Professor Essien Udom of the Ibadan University. We were both happy to see each other. We'd met in the United States as he had researched the Nation of Islam for his book, Black Nationalism. At his home that evening, a dinner was held in my honor, attended by other professors and professional people. As we ate, a young doctor asked me if I knew that New York City's press was highly upset about a recent killing in Harlem of a white woman, for which, according to the press, many were blaming me, at least indirectly. An elderly white couple who owned a Harlem clothing store had been attacked by several young Negroes, and the wife was stabbed to death. Some of these young Negroes, apprehended by the police, had described themselves as belonging to an organization they called Blood Brothers. These youths, allegedly, had said or implied that they were affiliated with black Muslims who had split away from the Nation of Islam to join up with me. I told the dinner guests that it was my first word of any of it, but that I was not surprised when violence happened in any of America's ghettos where black men had been living packed like animals and treated like lepers. I said that the charge against me was typical white man scapegoat seeking, that whenever something white men disliked happened in the black community, typically white public attention was directed not at the cause, but at a selected scapegoat. As for the Blood Brothers, I said I considered all Negroes to be my blood brothers. I said that the white man's efforts to make my name poison actually succeeded only in making millions of black people regard me like Joe Lewis. Speaking in the Ibadan University's Trenchard Hall, I urged that Africa's independent nations needed to see the necessity of helping to bring the Afro-Americans' case before the United Nations. I said that just as the American Jew is in political, economic, and cultural harmony with world Jewry, I was convinced that it was time for all Afro-Americans to join the world's Pan-Africanists. I said that physically we Afro-Americans might remain in America, fighting for our constitutional rights, but that philosophically and culturally, we Afro-Americans badly needed to return to Africa and to develop a working unity in the framework of Pan-Africanism. Young Africans asked me politically sharper questions than one hears from most American adults. Then an astonishing thing happened when one old West Indian stood and began attacking me for attacking America. "Shut up! Shut up!" students yelled, booing and hissing. The old West Indian tried to express defiance of them, and in a sudden rush a group of students sprang up and were after him. He barely escaped ahead of them. I never saw anything like it. Screaming at him, they ran him off the campus. Later I found out that the old West Indian was married to a white woman and he was trying to get a job in some white-influenced agency which had put him up to challenge me. Then I understood his problem. This wasn't the last time I'd see the Africans' almost fanatic expression of their political emotions. Afterward, in the Students' Union, I was plied with questions, and I was made an honorary member of the Nigerian Muslim Students' Society. Right here in my wallet is my card. Alhaji Malcolm X, registration number M138. With the membership, I was given a new name, Omowale. It means in the Yoruba language, the son who has come home. I meant it when I told them I had never received a more treasured honor. 600 members of the Peace Corps were in Nigeria, I learned. Some white Peace Corps members who talked with me were openly embarrassed at the guilt of their race in America. Among the 20 Negro Peace Corpsmen I talked with, a very impressive fellow to me was Larry Jackson, a Morgan State College graduate from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, who had joined the Peace Corps in 1962. I made Nigerian radio and television program appearances. When I remember seeing black men operating their own communications agencies, a thrill still runs up my spine. The reporters who interviewed me included an American Negro from Newsweek magazine. His name was Williams. Traveling through Africa, he had recently interviewed Prime Minister Nkrumah. Talking with me privately, one group of Nigerian officials told me how skillfully the U.S. Information Agency sought to spread among Africans the impression that American Negroes were steadily advancing and that the race problem soon would be solved. One high official told me, "Our informed leaders and many, many others know otherwise." He said that behind the diplomatic front of every African UN official was recognition of the white man's gigantic duplicity and conspiracy to keep the world's peoples of African heritage separated, both physically and ideologically, from each other. In your land, how many black people think about it that South and Central and North America contain over 80 million people of African descent? He asked me. The world's course will change the day the African heritage peoples come together as brothers. I never had heard that kind of global black thinking from any black man in America. From Lagos, Nigeria, I flew on to Accra, Ghana. I think that nowhere is the black continent's wealth and the natural beauty of its people richer than in Ghana, which is so proudly the very fountainhead of Pan-Africanism. I stepped off the plane into a jarring note. A red-faced American white man recognized me. He had the nerve to come up grabbing my hand and telling me in a molasses drawl that he was from Alabama, and then he invited me to his home for dinner. My hotel's dining room when I went to breakfast was full of more of those whites, discussing Africa's untapped wealth as though the African waiters had no ears. It nearly ruined my meal, thinking how in America they sicked police dogs on black people and threw bombs in black churches while blocking the doors of their white churches, and now once again in the land where their forefathers had stolen blacks and thrown them into slavery was that white man. Right there at my Ghanaian breakfast table was where I made up my mind that as long as I was in Africa, every time I opened my mouth, I was going to make things hot for that white man, grinning through his teeth, wanting to exploit Africa again. It had been her human wealth the last time. Now he wanted Africa's mineral wealth. And I knew that my reacting as I did presented no conflict with the convictions of brotherhood which I'd gained in the Holy Land. The Muslims of white complexions who had changed my opinions were men who had showed me that they practiced genuine brotherhood. And I knew that any American white man with a genuine brotherhood for a black man was hard to find, no matter how much he'd grinned. The author, Julian Mayfield, seemed to be the leader of Ghana's little colony of Afro-American expatriates. When I telephoned Mayfield, in what seemed no time at all, I was sitting in his home, surrounded by about 40 black American expatriates. They had been waiting for my arrival. There were business and professional people, such as the militant former Brooklynites, Dr. and Mrs. Robert E. Lee, both of them dentists who had given up their United States citizenship, such others as Alice Windham, Maya Angelou Marque, Victoria Garvin, and Leslie Lacey had even formed a Malcolm X committee to guide me through a whirlwind calendar of appearances and social events. In my briefcase, here are some of the African press stories which had appeared when it was learned that I was en route. Malcolm X's name is almost as familiar to Ghanaians as the southern dogs, fire hoses, cattle prods, people sticks, and the ugly, hate-contorted white faces. Malcolm X's decision to enter the mainstream of the struggle heralds a hopeful sign on the sickeningly dismal scene of brutalized, non-violent, passive resistance. An extremely important fact is that Malcolm X is the first Afro-American leader of national standing to make an independent trip to Africa since Dr. Du Bois came to Ghana. This may be the beginning of a new phase in our struggle. Let's make sure we don't give it less thought than the State Department is doubtless giving it right now. And another. Malcolm X is one of our most significant and militant leaders. We are in a battle. Efforts will be made to malign and discredit him. I simply couldn't believe this kind of reception 5,000 miles from America. The officials of the press had even arranged to pay my hotel expenses, and they would hear no objection that I made. They included T.D. Bafour, the editor-in-chief of the Ghanaian Times, G.T. Anim, the managing director of the Ghana News Agency, Kofi Batsa, the editor of Spark and the secretary general of the Pan-African Union of Journalists, and Mr. Cameron Dwodu, and others. I could only thank them all. Then, during the beautiful dinner which had been prepared by Julian Mayfield's pretty Puerto Rican wife, Ana Livia, she was in charge of Accra's district health program, I was plied with questions by the eagerly interested black expatriates from America who had returned to Mother Africa. I can only wish that every American black man could have shared my ears, my eyes, and my emotions throughout the round of engagements which had been made for me in Ghana. And my point in saying this is not the reception that I personally received as an individual of whom they had heard, but it was the reception tendered to me as the symbol of the militant American black man, as I had the honor to be regarded. At a jam-packed press club conference, I believe the very first question was why had I split with Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam. The Africans had heard such rumors as that Elijah Muhammad had built a palace in Arizona. I straightened out that falsehood, and I avoided any criticism. I said that our disagreement had been in terms of political direction and involvement in the extra-religious struggle for human rights. I said I respected the Nation of Islam for its having been a psychologically revitalizing movement and a source of moral and social reform, and that Elijah Muhammad's influence upon the American black man had been basic. I stressed to the assembled press the need for mutual communication and support between the Africans and Afro-Americans whose struggles were interlocked. I remember that in the press conference I used the word Negro, and I was firmly corrected. The word is not favored here, Mr. Malcolm X. The term Afro-American has greater meaning and dignity. I sincerely apologized. I don't think that I said Negro again as long as I was in Africa. I said that the 22 million Afro-Americans in the United States could become for Africa a great positive force, while in turn the African nations could and should exert positive force at diplomatic levels against America's racial discrimination. I said, all of Africa unites in opposition to South Africa's apartheid and to the oppression in the Portuguese territories. But you waste your time if you don't realize that Vervoort and Salazar and Britain and France never could last a day if it were not for United States support. So until you expose the man in Washington, D.C., you haven't accomplished anything. I knew that the State Department's G. Menin Williams was officially visiting in Africa. I said, take my word for it. You be suspicious of all these American officials who come to Africa grinning in your faces when they don't grin in ours back home. I told them that my own father was murdered by whites in the state of Michigan, where G. Menin Williams once was the governor. I was honored at the Ghana Club by more press representatives and dignitaries. I was the guest at the home of the late black American author Richard Wright's daughter, beautiful, slender, soft-voiced Julia, whose young French husband publishes a Ghanaian paper. Later in Paris, I was to meet Richard Wright's widow, Ellen, and a younger daughter, Rachel. I talked with ambassadors at their embassies. The Algerian ambassador impressed me as a man who was dedicated totally to militancy and to world revolution as the way to solve the problems of the world's oppressed masses. His perspective was attuned not just to Algerians, but to include the Afro-Americans and all others anywhere who were oppressed. The Chinese ambassador, Mr. Huang Ha, a most perceptive and also most militant man, focused upon the efforts of the West to divide Africans from the peoples of African heritage elsewhere. The Nigerian ambassador was deeply concerned about the Afro-Americans' plight in America. He had personal knowledge of their suffering, having lived and studied in Washington, D.C. Similarly, the most sympathetic Mali ambassador had been in New York of the United Nations. I breakfasted with Dr. McConnin of British Guiana. We discussed the need for the type of Pan-African unity that would also include the Afro-Americans. And I had a talk in depth about Afro-American problems with Nana Nketsia, the Ghanaian Minister of Culture. Once, when I returned to my hotel, a New York City call was waiting for me from Mal Good of the American Broadcasting Company. Over the telephone, Mal Good asked me questions that I answered for his beeping tape recorder about the Blood Brothers in Harlem, the rifle clubs for Negroes, and other subjects with which I was being kept identified in the American press. In the University of Ghana's Great Hall, I addressed the largest audience that I would in Africa, mostly Africans, but also numerous whites. Before this audience, I tried my best to demolish the false image of American race relations that I knew was spread by the U.S. Information Agency. I tried to impress upon them all the true picture of the Afro-Americans' plight at the hands of the white man. I worked on those whites there in the audience. I've never seen so many whites so nice to so many blacks as you white people here in Africa. In America, Afro-Americans are struggling for integration. They should come here, to Africa, and see how you grin at Africans. You've really got integration here. But can you tell the Africans that in America you grin at the black people? No, you can't. And you don't honestly like these Africans any better either. But what you do like is the minerals Africa has under her soil. Those whites out in the audience turned pink and red. They knew I was telling the truth. I'm not anti-American, and I didn't come here to condemn America. I want to make that very clear, I told them. I came here to tell the truth. And if the truth condemns America, then she stands condemned. One evening I met most of the officials in Ghana, all of those with whom I'd previously talked, and more, at a party that was given for me by the Honorable Kofi Bako, the Ghanaian Minister of Defense and the leader of the National Assembly. I was told that this was the first time such an honor was accorded to a foreigner since Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois had come to Ghana. There was music, dancing, and fine Ghanaian food. Several persons at the party were laughing among themselves, saying that in an earlier party that day, U.S. Ambassador Mahomi was knocking himself out being exceptionally friendly and jovial. Some thought that he was making a strong effort to counteract the truth about America that I was telling every chance I got. Then an invitation came to me which exceeded my wildest dream. I would never have imagined that I would actually have an opportunity to address the members of the Ghanaian Parliament. I made my remarks brief, but I made them strong. How can you condemn Portugal and South Africa while our black people in America are being bitten by dogs and beaten with clubs? I said I felt certain that the only reason black Africans, our black brothers, could be so silent about what happened in America was that they had been misinformed by the American government's propaganda agencies. At the end of my talk I heard, "Yes, we support the Afro-American, morally, physically, materially, if necessary, in Ghana or in all of black Africa." My highest single honor was an audience at the castle with Osagyefo Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. Before seeing him, I was searched most thoroughly. I respected the type of security the Ghanaians erect around their leader. It gave me that much more respect for independent black men. Then, as I entered Dr. Nkrumah's long office, he came out from behind his desk at the far end. Dr. Nkrumah wore ordinary dress, his hand was extended, and a smile was on his sensitive face. I pumped his hand. We sat on a couch and talked. I knew that he was particularly well informed on the Afro-Americans' plight, as for years he had lived and studied in America. We discussed the unity of Africans and peoples of African descent. We agreed that Pan-Africanism was the key also to the problems of those of African heritage. I could feel the warm, likable, and very down-to-earth qualities of Dr. Nkrumah. My time with him was up all too soon. I promised faithfully that when I returned to the United States, I would relay to Afro-Americans his personal warm regards. That afternoon, 39 miles away in Winneba, I spoke at the Kwame Nkrumah Ideological Institute, where 200 students were being trained to carry forward Ghana's intellectual revolution. And here again occurred one of those astounding demonstrations of the young African's political fervor. After I'd spoken, during the question and answer period, some young Afro-American stood up whom none there seemed to know. "I am an American Negro," he announced himself. Vaguely, he defended the American white man. The African students booed and harassed him. Then instantly, when the meeting was over, they cornered this fellow with verbal abuse. "Are you an agent of Rockefeller? Stop corrupting our children." The fellow had turned out to be a local secondary school teacher placed in the job by an American agency. "Come to this institute for some orientation." Temporarily, a teacher rescued the fellow, but then the students rushed him and drove him away, shouting, "Stooge! CIA! American agent!" Chinese Ambassador and Mrs. Huang Hua gave a state dinner in my honor. The guests included the Cuban and the Algerian ambassadors, and also it was here that I met Mrs. W.E.B. Du Bois. After the excellent dinner, three films were shown. One, a color film, depicted the People's Republic of China in celebration of its 14th anniversary. Prominently shown in this film was the militant former North Carolina Afro-American Robert Williams, who has since taken refuge in Cuba after his advocacy that the American black people should take up arms to defend and protect themselves. The second film focused upon the Chinese people's support for the Afro-American struggle. Chairman Mao Tse-tung was shown delivering his statement of that support, and the film offered sickening moments of graphic white brutality, police and civilian, to Afro-Americans who were demonstrating in various U.S. cities seeking civil rights. And the final film was a dramatic presentation of the Algerian Revolution. The Malcolm X Committee rushed me from the Chinese embassy dinner to where a soiree in my honor had already begun, at the press club. It was my first sight of Ghanaians dancing the high life. A high and merry time was being had by everyone, and I was pressed to make a short speech. I stressed again the need for unity between Africans and Afro-Americans. I cried out of my heart, "Now dance, sing, but as you do, remember Mandela, remember Sobukwe, remember Lumumba in his grave, remember South Africans now in jail." I said, "You wonder why I don't dance? Because I want you to remember 22 million Afro-Americans in the U.S. But I sure felt like dancing. The Ghanaians performed the high life as if possessed. One pretty African girl sang Blue Moon, like Sarah Vaughan. Sometimes the band sounded like Milt Jackson, sometimes like Charlie Parker. The next morning, Saturday, I heard that Cassius Clay and his entourage had arrived. There was a huge reception for him at the airport. I thought that if Cassius and I happened to meet, it would likely prove embarrassing for Cassius, since he had elected to remain with Elijah Muhammad's version of Islam. I would not have been embarrassed, but I knew that Cassius would have been forbidden to associate with me. I knew that Cassius knew I had been with him, and for him, and believed in him, when those who later embraced him felt that he had no chance. I decided to avoid Cassius, so as not to put him on the spot. A luncheon was given for me that afternoon by the Nigerian High Commissioner, His Excellency Alhaji Isa Wali, a short, bespectacled, extremely warm and friendly man who had lived in Washington, D.C. for 2 years. After lunch, His Excellency spoke to the guests of his American encounters with discrimination, and of friendships he had made with Afro-Americans, and he reaffirmed the bonds between Africans and Afro-Americans. His Excellency held up before the luncheon guests a large and handsome issue of an American magazine, Horizon. It was open to an article about the Nation of Islam, written by Dr. Mauro Berger of Princeton University. One full page was a photograph of me. The opposite full page was a beautiful color illustration of a black royal Nigerian Muslim, stalwart and handsome, of hundreds of years ago. "When I look at these photographs, I know these two people are one," said His Excellency. "The only difference is in their attire, and one was born in America and the other in Africa. So to let everyone know that I believe we are brothers, I am going to give to Alhaji Malcolm X a robe like that worn by the Nigerian in this photo." I was overwhelmed by the splendor of the beautiful blue robe and the orange turban which His Excellency then presented to me. I bent over so that he, a short man, could properly arrange the turban on my head. His Excellency Alhaji Isa Wali also presented me with a two-volume translation of the Holy Quran. After this unforgettable luncheon, Mrs. Shirley Graham Du Bois drove me to her home so that I could see and photograph the home where her famed late husband, Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, had spent his last days. Mrs. Du Bois, a writer, was the director of Ghanaian television, which was planned for educational purposes. When Dr. Du Bois had come to Ghana, she told me, Dr. Nkrumah had set up the aging great militant Afro-American scholar like a king, giving to Dr. Du Bois everything he could wish for. Mrs. Du Bois told me that when Dr. Du Bois was failing fast, Dr. Nkrumah had visited, and the two men had said goodbye, both knowing that one's death was near. And Dr. Nkrumah had gone away in tears. My final Ghanaian social event was a beautiful party in my honor given by His Excellency Mr. Armando Entralgo Gonzalez, the Cuban ambassador to Ghana. The next morning, it was Sunday, the Malcolm X committee was waiting in my hotel to accompany me to the airport. As we left the hotel, we met Cassius Clay with some of his entourage returning from his morning walk. Cassius momentarily seemed uncertain. Then he spoke, something almost monosyllabic, like, "How are you?" It flashed through my mind how close we had been before the fight that had changed the course of his life. I replied that I was fine, something like that, and that I hoped he was, which I sincerely meant. Later on, I sent Cassius a message by wire saying that I hoped that he would realize how much he was loved by Muslims wherever they were, and that he would not let anyone use him and maneuver him into saying and doing things to tarnish his image. The Malcolm X committee and I were exchanging goodbyes at the Accra airport when a small motorcade of 5 ambassadors arrived to see me off. I no longer had any words. In the plane, bound for Monrovia, Liberia, to spend a day, I knew that after what I had experienced in the Holy Land, the second most indelible memory I would carry back to America would be the Africa, seething with serious awareness of itself and of Africa's wealth and of her power and of her destined role in the world. From Monrovia, I flew to Dakar, Senegal. The Senegalese in the airport, hearing about the Muslim from America, stood in line to shake my hand, and I signed many autographs. "Our people can't speak Arabic, but we have Islam in our hearts," said one Senegalese. I told them that exactly described their fellow Afro-American Muslims. From Dakar, I flew to Morocco, where I spent a day sightseeing. I visited the famous Casbah, the ghetto which had resulted when the ruling white French wouldn't let the dark-skinned natives into certain areas of Casablanca. Thousands upon thousands of the subjugated natives were crowded into the ghetto in the same way that Harlem in New York City became America's Casbah. It was Tuesday, May 19th, 1964, my 39th birthday, when I arrived in Algiers. A lot of water had gone under the bridge in those years. In some ways, I had had more experiences than a dozen men. The taxi driver, while taking me to the Hotel Aletti, described the atrocities the French had committed and personal measures that he'd taken to get even. I walked around Algiers, hearing rank-and-file expressions of hatred for America for supporting the oppressors of the Algerians. They were true revolutionists, not afraid of death. They had, for so long, faced death. The Pan American jet which took me home, it was Flight 115, landed at New York's Kennedy Air Terminal on May 21st at 4:25 in the afternoon. We passengers filed off the plane and toward customs. When I saw the crowd of 50 or 60 reporters and photographers, I honestly wondered what celebrity I'd been on the plane with. But I was the villain they had come to meet. In Harlem especially, and also in some other U.S. cities, the 1964 long, hot summer's predicted explosions had begun. Article after article in the white man's press had cast me as a symbol, if not a causative agent, of the revolt and of the violence of the American black man, wherever it had sprung up. In the biggest press conference that I had ever experienced anywhere, the camera bulbs flashed and the reporters fired questions. Mr. Malcolm X, what about those Blood Brothers, reportedly affiliated with your organization, reportedly trained for violence, who have killed innocent white people? Mr. Malcolm X, what about your comment that Negroes should form rifle clubs? I answered the questions. I knew I was back in America again, hearing the subjective, scapegoat-seeking questions of the white man. New York white youth were killing victims. That was a sociological problem. But when black youth killed somebody, the power structure was looking to hang somebody. When black men had been lynched or otherwise murdered in cold blood, it was always said, things will get better. When whites had rifles in their homes, the Constitution gave them the right to protect their home and themselves. But when black people even spoke of having rifles in their homes, that was ominous. I slipped in on the reporters something they hadn't been expecting. I said that the American black man needed to quit thinking what the white man had taught him, which was that the black man had no alternative except to beg for his so-called civil rights. I said that the American black man needed to recognize that he had a strong, airtight case to take the United States before the United Nations on a formal accusation of denial of human rights, and that if Angola and South Africa were precedent cases, then there would be no easy way that the U.S. could escape being censured right on its own home ground. Just as I'd known, the press wanted to get me off that subject. I was asked about my letter from Mecca. I was all set with a speech regarding that. I hope that once and for all, my Hajj to the holy city of Mecca has established our Muslim mosque's authentic religious affiliation with the 750 million Muslims of the Orthodox Islamic world. And I know, once and for all, that the black Africans look upon America's 22 million blacks as long-lost brothers. They love us. They study our struggle for freedom. They were so happy to hear how we are awakening from our long sleep after so-called Christian white America had taught us to be ashamed of our African brothers and homeland. Yes, I wrote a letter from Mecca. You're asking me, didn't you say that now you accept white men as brothers? Well, my answer is that in the Muslim world, I saw, I felt, and I wrote home how my thinking was broadened. Just as I wrote, I shared true brotherly love with many white-complexioned Muslims who never gave a single thought to the race or to the complexion of another Muslim. My pilgrimage broadened my scope. It blessed me with a new insight. In 2 weeks in the Holy Land, I saw what I never had seen in 39 years here in America. I saw all races, all colors, blue-eyed blondes to black-skinned Africans in true brotherhood, in unity, living as one, worshipping as one. No segregationists, no liberals. They would not have known how to interpret the meaning of those words. In the past, yes, I have made sweeping indictments of all white people. I never will be guilty of that again. As I know now that some white people are truly sincere, that some truly are capable of being brotherly toward a black man. The true Islam has shown me that a blanket indictment of all white people is as wrong as when whites make blanket indictments against blacks. Yes, I have been convinced that some American whites do want to help cure the rampant racism which is on the path to destroying this country. It was in the Holy World that my attitude was changed by what I experienced there and by what I witnessed there in terms of brotherhood, not just brotherhood toward me, but brotherhood between all men of all nationalities and complexions who were there. And now that I'm back in America, my attitude here concerning white people has to be governed by what my black brothers and I experience here and what we witness here in terms of brotherhood. The problem here in America is that we meet such a small minority of individual so-called good or brotherly white people. Here in the United States, notwithstanding those few good white people, it is the collective 150 million white people whom the collective 22 million black people have to deal with. Why, here in America, the seeds of racism are so deeply rooted in the white people collectively, their belief that they are superior in some way is so deeply rooted that these things are in the national white subconsciousness. Many whites are even actually unaware of their own racism until they face some test, and then their racism emerges in one form or another. Listen, The white man's racism toward the black man here in America is what has got him in such trouble all over this world with other non-white peoples. The white man can't separate himself from the stigma that he automatically feels about anyone, no matter who is not his color. And the non-white peoples of the world are sick of the condescending white man. That's why you've got all of this trouble in places like Vietnam, or right here in the Western Hemisphere. Probably 100 million people of African descent are divided against each other, taught by the white man to hate and to mistrust each other. In the West Indies, Cuba, Brazil, Venezuela, all of South America, Central America, all of those lands are full of people with African blood. On the African continent, even, the white man has maneuvered to divide the black African from the brown Arab, to divide the so-called Christian African from the Muslim African. Can you imagine what can happen, what would certainly happen, if all of these African heritage peoples ever realize their blood bonds, if they ever realize they all have a common goal, if they ever unite? The press was glad to get rid of me that day. I believe that the black brothers whom I just recently left in Africa would have felt that I did the subject justice. Nearly through the night, my telephone at home kept ringing. My black brothers and sisters around New York and in some other cities were calling to congratulate me on what they'd heard on the radio and television news broadasts. And people, mostly white, were wanting to know if I would speak here or there. The next day I was in my car driving along the freeway when at a red light another car pulled alongside. A white woman was driving, and on the passenger side, next to me, was a white man. "Malcolm X," he called out. And when I looked, he stuck his hand out of his car across at me, grinning. "Do you mind shaking hands with a white man?" Imagine that. Just as the traffic light turned green, I told him, "I don't mind shaking hands with human beings. Are you one?" Chapter 19. 1965. I must be honest. Negroes, Afro-Americans, showed no inclination to rush to the United Nations and demand justice for themselves here in America. I really had known in advance that they wouldn't. The American white man has so thoroughly brainwashed the black man to see himself as only a domestic civil rights problem that it will probably take longer than I live before the Negro sees that the struggle of the American black man is international. And I'd known, too, the Negroes would not rush to follow me into the orthodox Islam, which had given me the insight and perspective to see that the black man and white man truly could be brothers. America's Negroes, especially older Negroes, are too indelibly soaked in Christianity's double standard of oppression. So in the public-invited meetings which I began holding each Sunday afternoon or evening in Harlem's well-known Audubon Ballroom, as I addressed predominantly non-Muslim Negro audiences, I did not immediately attempt to press the Islamic religion, but instead to embrace all who sat before me. Not Muslim, nor Christian, Catholic, nor Protestant, Baptist, nor Methodist, Democrat, nor Republican, Mason, nor Elk. I mean the black people of America, and the black people all over this earth, because it is as this collective mass of black people that we have been deprived not only of our civil rights, but even of our human rights, the right to human dignity. On the streets, after my speeches, in the faces and the voices of the people I met, even those who would pump my hands and want my autograph, I would feel the wait-and-see attitude. I would feel, and I understood, their uncertainty about where I stood. Since the Civil War's freedom, the black man has gone down so many fruitless paths. His leaders, very largely, had failed him. The religion of Christianity had failed him. The black man was scarred. He was cautious. He was apprehensive. I understood it better now than I had before. In the Holy World, away from America's race problem, was the first time I ever had been able to think clearly about the basic divisions of white people in America, and how their attitudes and their motives related to and affected Negroes. In my 39 years on this earth, the holy city of Mecca had been the first time I had ever stood before the Creator of all and felt like a complete human being. In that peace of the Holy World, in fact, the very night I mentioned, when I lay awake surrounded by snoring brother pilgrims, my mind took me back to personal memories I would have thought were gone forever, as far back, even, as when I was just a little boy, 8 or 9 years old. Out behind our house, out in the country from Lansing, Michigan, there was an old grassy Hector's Hill, we called it, which may still be there. I remembered there in the Holy World how I used to lie on the top of Hector's Hill and look up at the sky, at the clouds moving over me, and daydream, all kinds of things. And then, in a funny contrast of recollections, I remembered how years later, when I was in prison, I used to lie on my cell bunk. This would be especially when I was in solitary, what we convicts called the hole. And I would picture myself talking to large crowds. I don't have any idea why such previsions came to me, but they did. To tell that to anyone then would have sounded crazy. Even I didn't have myself the slightest inkling. In Mecca, too, I'd played back for myself the 12 years I'd spent with Elijah Muhammad as if it were a motion picture. I guess it would be impossible for anyone ever to realize fully how complete was my belief in Elijah Muhammad. I believed in him not only as a leader in the ordinary human sense, but also I believed in him as a divine leader. I believed he had no human weaknesses or faults, and that therefore he could make no mistakes, and that he could do no wrong. There on a holy world hilltop, I realized how very dangerous it is for people to hold any human being in such esteem, especially to consider anyone some sort of divinely guided and protected person. My thinking had been opened up wide in Mecca. In the long letters I wrote to friends, I tried to convey to them my new insights into the American black man's struggle and his problems, as well as the depths of my search for truth and justice. "I've had enough of someone else's propaganda," I'd written to these friends. "I'm for truth, no matter who tells it. I'm for justice, no matter who it is for or against. I'm a human being, first and foremost, and as such I'm for whoever and whatever benefits humanity as a whole." Largely, the American white man's press refused to convey that I was now attempting to teach Negroes a new direction. With the 1964 long hot summer steadily producing new incidents, I was constantly accused of stirring up Negroes. Every time I had another radio or television microphone at my mouth, when I was asked about stirring up Negroes or inciting violence, I'd get hot. It takes no one to stir up the sociological dynamite that stems from the unemployment, bad housing, and inferior education already in the ghettos. This explosively criminal condition has existed for so long it needs no fuse. It fuses itself. It spontaneously combusts from within itself. They called me the angriest Negro in America. I wouldn't deny that charge. I spoke exactly as I felt. I believe in anger. The Bible says there is a time for anger. They called me a teacher, a fomenter of violence. I would say point blank, that's a lie. I'm not for wanton violence, I'm for justice. I feel that if white people were attacked by Negroes, if the forces of law prove unable or inadequate or reluctant to protect those whites from those Negroes, then those white people should protect and defend themselves from those Negroes, using arms if necessary. And I feel that when the law fails to protect Negroes from whites' attack, then those Negroes should use arms, if necessary, to defend themselves. Malcolm X advocates armed Negroes. What was wrong with that? I'll tell you what was wrong. I was a black man talking about physical defense against the white man. The white man can lynch and burn and bomb and beat Negroes. That's all right. Have patience. The customs are entrenched. Things are getting better. Well, I believe it's a crime for anyone who is being brutalized to continue to accept that brutality without doing something to defend himself. If that's how Christian philosophy is interpreted, if that's what Gandhian philosophy teaches, well then, I will call them criminal philosophies. I tried in every speech I made to clarify my new position regarding white people. I don't speak against the sincere, well-meaning, good white people. I have learned that there are some. I have learned that not all white people are racists. I am speaking against, and my fight is against the white racists. I firmly believe that Negroes have the right to fight against these racists by any means that are necessary. But the white reporters kept wanting me linked with that word, violence. I doubt if I had one interview without having to deal with that accusation. I am for violence if nonviolence means we continue postponing a solution to the American black man's problem, just to avoid violence. I don't go for nonviolence if it also means a delayed solution. To me, a delayed solution is a non-solution. Or I'll say it another way. If it must take violence to get the black man his human rights in this country, I am for violence exactly as, you know, the Irish, the Poles, or Jews would be if they were flagrantly discriminated against. I am just as they would be in that case, and they would be for violence, no matter what the consequences, no matter who was hurt by the violence. White society hates to hear anybody, especially a black man, talk about the crime the white man has perpetrated on the black man. I've always understood that's why I've been so frequently called a revolutionist. It sounds as if I have done some crime. Well, it may be the American black man does need to become involved in a real revolution. The word for revolution in German is Umwälzung. What it means is a complete overturn, a complete change. The overthrow of King Farouk in Egypt and the succession of President Nasser is an example of a true revolution. It means the destroying of an old system and its replacement with a new system. Another example is the Algerian Revolution, led by Ben Bella. They threw out the French, who had been there over 100 years. So how does anybody sound talking about the Negro in America waging some revolution? Yes, he's condemning a system, but he's not trying to overturn the system or to destroy it. The Negro's so-called revolt is merely an asking to be accepted into the existing system. A true Negro revolt might entail, for instance, fighting for separate black states within this country, which several groups and individuals have advocated long before Elijah Muhammad came along. When the white man came into this country, he certainly wasn't demonstrating any nonviolence. In fact, the very man whose name symbolizes nonviolence here today has stated, "Our nation was born in genocide when it embraced the doctrine that the original American, the Indian, was an inferior race. Even before there were large numbers of Negroes on our shores, the scar of racial hatred had already disfigured colonial society. From the 16th century forward, blood flowed in battles over racial supremacy. We are perhaps the only nation which tried as a matter of national policy to wipe out its indigenous population. Moreover, we elevated that tragic experience into a noble crusade. Indeed, even today, we have not permitted ourselves to reject or to feel remorse for this shameful episode. Our literature, our films, our drama, our folklore, all exalt it. Our children are still taught to respect the violence which reduced a red-skinned people of an earlier culture into a few fragmented groups herded into impoverished reservations." Peaceful coexistence. That's another one the white man has always been quick to cry. Fine, but what have been the deeds of the white man? During his entire advance through history, he has been waving the banner of Christianity and carrying in his other hand the sword and the flintlock. You can go right back to the very beginning of Christianity. Catholicism, the genesis of Christianity as we know it to be presently constituted, with its hierarchy, was conceived in Africa by those whom the Christian Church calls the Desert Fathers. The Christian Church became infected with racism when it entered white Europe. The Christian Church returned to Africa under the banner of the cross, conquering, killing, exploiting, pillaging, raping, bullying, beating, and teaching white supremacy. This is how the white man thrust himself into the position of leadership of the world, through the use of naked physical power. And he was totally inadequate spiritually. Mankind's history has proved from one era to another that the true criterion of leadership is spiritual. Men are attracted by spirit. By power, men are forced. Love is engendered by spirit. By power, anxieties are created. I am in agreement 100% with those racists who say that no government laws ever can force brotherhood. The only true world solution today is governments guided by true religion, of the spirit. Here in race-torn America, I am convinced that the Islam religion is desperately needed, particularly by the American black man. The black man needs to reflect that he has been America's most fervent Christian. And where has it gotten him? In fact, in the white man's hands, in the white man's interpretation, where has Christianity brought this world? It has brought the non-white two-thirds of the human population to rebellion, Two-thirds of the human population today is telling the one-third minority white man, get out. And the white man is leaving. And as he leaves, we see the non-white peoples returning in a rush to their original religions, which had been labeled pagan by the conquering white man. Only one religion, Islam, had the power to stand and fight the white man's Christianity for 1,000 years. Only Islam could keep white Christianity at bay. The Africans are returning to Islam and other indigenous religions. The Asians are returning to being Hindus, Buddhists, and Muslims. As the Christian crusade once went east, now the Islamic crusade is going west. With the East, Asia, closed to Christianity, with Africa rapidly being converted to Islam, with Europe rapidly becoming un-Christian, generally today it is accepted that the Christian civilization of America, which is propping up the white race around the world, is Christianity's remaining strongest bastion. Well, if this is so, if the so-called Christianity now being practiced in America displays the best that world Christianity has left to offer, no one in his right mind should need any much greater proof that very close at hand is the end of Christianity. Are you aware that some Protestant theologians, in their writings, are using the phrase post-Christian era? And they mean now? And what is the greatest single reason for this Christian church's failure? It is its failure to combat racism. It is the old you sow, you reap story. The Christian church sowed racism blasphemously. Now it reaps racism. Sunday mornings in this year of grace, 1965, imagine the Christian conscience of congregations guarded by deacons barring the door to black would-be worshippers, telling them, you can't enter this house of God. Tell me if you can, a sadder irony than that St. Augustine, Florida, a city named for the black African saint who saved Catholicism from heresy, was recently the scene of bloody race riots. I believe that God now is giving the world's so-called Christian white society its last opportunity to repent and atone for the crimes of exploiting and enslaving the world's non-white peoples. It is exactly as when God gave Pharaoh a chance to repent, but Pharaoh persisted in his refusal to give justice to those whom he oppressed, and we know God finally destroyed Pharaoh. Is white America really sorry for our crimes against the black people? Does white America have the capacity to repent and to atone? Does the capacity to repent, to atone, exist in a majority, in one half, in even one-third of American white society? Many black men, the victims, in fact most black men, would like to be able to forgive, to forget the crimes. But most American white people seem not to have it in them to make any serious atonement, to do justice to the black man. Indeed, how can white society atone for enslaving, for raping, for unmanning, for otherwise brutalizing millions of human beings for centuries? What atonement would the God of justice demand for the robbery of the black people's labor, their lives, their true identities, their culture, their history, and even their human dignity? A desegregated cup of coffee? A theater? Public toilets? The whole range of hypocritical integration. These are not atonement. After a while in America, I returned abroad. And this time, I spent 18 weeks in the Middle East and Africa. The world leaders with whom I had private audiences this time included President Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt, President Julius K. Nyerere of Tanzania, President Namoi Atsikwe of Nigeria, Osagyefo Dr. Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana, President Sekou Touré of Guinea, President Jomo Kenyatta of Kenya, and Prime Minister Dr. Milton Obote of Uganda. I also met with religious leaders, African, Arab, Asian, Muslim, and non-Muslim. And in all of these countries, I talked with Afro-Americans and whites of many professions and backgrounds. An American white ambassador in one African country was Africa's most respected American ambassador. I'm glad to say that this was told to me by one ranking African leader. We talked for an entire afternoon. Based on what I'd heard of him, I had to believe him when he told me that as long as he was on the African continent, he never thought in terms of race, that he dealt with human beings, never noticing their color. He said he was more aware of language differences than of color differences. He said that only when he returned to America would he become aware of color differences. I told him, "What you are telling me is that it isn't the American white man who is a racist, but it's the American political, economic, and social atmosphere that automatically nourishes a racist psychology in the white man." He agreed. We both agreed that American society makes it next to impossible for humans to meet in America and not be conscious of their color differences. And we both agreed that if racism could be removed, America could offer a society where rich and poor could truly live like human beings. That discussion with the ambassador gave me a new insight, one which I like, that the white man is not inherently evil, but America's racist society influences him to act evilly. The society has produced and nourishes a psychology which brings out the lowest, most base part of human beings. I had a totally different kind of talk with another white man I met in Africa, who to me personified exactly what the ambassador and I had discussed. Throughout my trip, I was of course aware that I was under constant surveillance. The agent was a particularly obvious and obnoxious one. I'm not sure for what agency, as he never identified it, or I would say it. Anyway, this one finally got under my skin when I found I couldn't seem to eat a meal in the hotel without seeing him somewhere around watching me. You would have thought I was John Dillinger or somebody. I just got up from my breakfast one morning and walked over to where he was, and I told him I knew he was following me, and if he wanted to know anything, why didn't he ask me? He started to give me one of those too lofty to descend to you attitudes. I told him then right to his face he was a fool, that he didn't know me or what I stood for, so that made him one of those people who let somebody else do their thinking, and that no matter what job a man had, at least he ought to be able to think for himself. That stung him. He let me have it. I was, to hear him tell it, anti-American, un-American, seditious, subversive, and probably communist. I told him that what he said only proved how little he understood about me. I told him that the only thing the FBI, the CIA, or anybody else could ever find me guilty of was being open-minded. I said I was seeking for the truth, and I was trying to weigh objectively everything on its own merit. I said what I was against was straight-jacketed thinking and straight-jacketed societies. I said I respected every man's right to believe whatever his intelligence tells him is intellectually sound, and I expect everyone else to respect my right to believe likewise. This super sleuth then got off on my black Muslim religious beliefs. I asked him hadn't his headquarters bothered to brief him that my attitudes and beliefs were changed. I told them that the Islam I believed in now was the Islam which was taught in Mecca, that there was no God but Allah, and that Muhammad ibn Abdullah, who lived in the holy city of Mecca 1400 years ago, was the last messenger of Allah. Almost from the first, I've been guessing about something, and I took a chance, and I really shook up that super sleuth. From the consistent subjectivity in just about everything he asked and said, I deduced something, and I told him, "You know, I think you're a Jew with an anglicized name." His involuntary expression told me I'd hit the button. He asked me how I knew. I told him I'd so much experience with how Jews would attack me that I usually could identify them. I told him all I held against the Jew was that so many Jews actually were hypocrites in their claim to be friends of the American black man, and it burned me up to be so often called anti-Semitic when I spoke things I knew to be the absolute truth about Jews. I told him that, yes, I gave the Jew credit for being among all other whites the most active and the most vocal financier, leader, and liberal in the Negro civil rights movement. But I said at the same time I knew that the Jew played these roles for a very careful, strategic reason. The more prejudice in America could be focused upon the Negro, then the more the white Gentile's prejudice would keep diverted off the Jew. I said that to me, one proof that all the civil rights posturing of so many Jews wasn't sincere was that so often in the North the quickest segregationists were Jews themselves. Look at practically everything the black man is trying to integrate into, for instance. If Jews are not the actual owners, or are not in controlling positions, then they have major stockholdings, or they are otherwise in powerful leverage positions. And do they really, sincerely exert these influences? No. And an even clearer proof for me of how Jews truly regard Negroes, I said, was what invariably happened wherever a Negro moved into any white residential neighborhood that was thickly Jewish. Who would always lead the whites' exodus? The Jews. Generally in these situations, some whites stay put. You just notice who they are. They're Irish Catholics. They're Italians. They're rarely ever any Jews. And ironically, the Jews themselves often still have trouble being accepted. Saying this, I know I'll hear anti-Semitic from every direction again. Oh, yes. But truth is truth. Politics dominated the American scene while I was traveling abroad this time. In Cairo and again in Accra, the American press wire services reached me with transatlantic calls, asking whom did I favor, Johnson or Goldwater? End of side 10.